Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
As a disabled person who's, you know, born with my disability, I grew up with adults always having very low expectations. I mean, there were definitely some teachers that just, you know, I thought like, oh, you know, why go to college? People just can't imagine people with significant disabilities doing well sometimes. And I think that's very messed up.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Disability rights activist Alice Wong lives in San Francisco. When I spoke with her recently, it was pretty early in the morning for her.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a night owl slash early bird, so this is great for me, so I love it.
Does that mean you sleep during the day? Are you nocturnal?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm a weirdo. I am basically Dracula, so.
Wait, so when did you last sleep? At what time?
3 p.m. yesterday.
Oh, it's when you woke up?
Yes.
When do you think you'll go to bed again?
Right after this.
What do you like about being up in the middle of the night?
Oh, I love just the quietness. I love just, you know, there aren't any distractions, especially, you know, I've been working from home for over 15 years, but, you know, I just love the solitude.
Alice recently edited a new book called Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. It's an essay collection with contributions from people with a wide range of disabilities who write with real candor and often humor. The whole thing's got a real death, sex, and money vibe. Alice has a form of muscular dystrophy. She uses a wheelchair to get around and wears a BiPAP machine to help her breathe, which you'll hear throughout our conversation. And like many people, Alice has been sheltering in place since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in the U.S. But in some ways, being home a lot has been familiar for her.
Much of my involvement with friends and relationships really does take place online already. So that part wasn't a huge adjustment in my life. I would say the biggest change has been kind of the low-key and not-so-low-key anxiety about, you know, catching the virus.
Alice isn't the only high-risk person in her household. She lives with her parents, who are both in their 70s. Alice is 46 now. Her parents have been her primary caregivers for most of her life.
That's something I always appreciated is that, you know, my parents sacrificed a lot. You know, it's very clear that whatever I needed in terms of time and support, you know, they were always there. And, you know, I'm sure, I know that I was a financial hardship on them. For example, I realized as a young person that there was no insurance that would cover me, except one company because of my pre-existing condition. And, you know, my dad told me that. I mean, he was just very honest about that. And it wasn't in a way to make me feel bad or to, like, shame me. But I think it was a real reality check. Like, this is the world we're living in.
It sounds like your dad described the world as it is to you. He didn't sugarcoat it. He's like, to insure you as part of our family costs extra money, and that's the reality of the society we're living in.
Yep. And it's funny because when I turned 18, he said, okay, you're 18 now. That means we're going to go to the county office and you're going to apply for Medicaid. And I was like, what? I was like, what is this happening? And my dad said, you know, you're now an adult. You are entitled to this. And that, you know, just think about the years of the huge costs to our family. You know, I was a young, you know, know-it-all, you know, teenager. And I was like, Medicaid, like, isn't that, you know, for poor people? And, you know, I was like, yes, it is. And I realized, you know, what it really means and that how vital these programs are because they really keep our community connected. You know, they really, you know, at least help support those who have the least. And that allows me to live at home and, you know, live with personal assistance instead of an institution. But like many other means-tested programs, to be on Medicaid solely because of my personal needs, I'm not allowed to have over $2,000 in my bank account, and there's actually a cap on how much I can earn per month. So all of these things have kept me from having, you know, 401ks, you know, the usual things that, you know, people tell adults they need to have for, like, as a death stage for the future. I don't have any of those things.
What's the monthly cap on what you're able to earn?
In California, I am on one that's called the Working Disabled Program. It allows me to earn up to 2.5 times the poverty rate. So 2.5 times the poverty rate, I believe, is to the bid, 40,000, I think. The last time I looked, I think it's 40-ish thousand.
How do you feel about that earning limit? Does it feel like a relief that there's only so much you can try to earn, or does it feel like a cap on your ambition?
It is absolutely a cap on my ambition. I think of it as one of the clearest examples of systemic ableism. You know, the fact that there's a limit purely because the way our society is organized, that if you need assistance to live every day, you know, let's say get out of bed, have people that work for you at your home to help you do the everyday activities of life. For those reasons alone, to survive, you're expected to have a trade-off, to live, you know, at poverty or near poverty. You know, that people don't realize is that to be poor or close to poverty, it takes a lot of work. I mean, it's basically a part-time job in terms of making sure you document everything, because you're constantly, as a disabled person, asked to prove your disability all the time. Just, you know, you have to always kind of reconfirm, yes, like, I do need these services, and yes, you have to repeat, like, all the different things that you cannot do, just to jump through the hoops to make sure that you are eligible.
Yeah, and it's this mix of you having to show the government that you are both deserving of help and also dependent enough, like need help enough. So it's this combination of showing worthiness and also vulnerability.
Yeah, and these things are often in conflicts.
Yeah.
So there's always, like, for me, like, hypervigilance about my bank balance, about my assets. Because no matter what happens in terms of no amount of extra income is worth not being on Medicaid. Because basically, Medicaid is a lifeline for me.
Alice grew up near Indianapolis, the oldest of three sisters. Her parents immigrated to the United States from Hong Kong a few years before she was born. She was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy as a toddler.
My disability world was completely separate from the Chinese-American community that I was part of. So we became involved in the local muscular dystrophy organization. So we attended, you know, various events, maybe once or twice a year, and, you know, that was a very, you know, white world, and I almost never saw anybody like myself there. Then we also had a very small Chinese American community that was it was centered around a church, and that was kind of my safe place. You know, people that, you know, talked like us, and like my sisters and I were lucky that we did have friends that we could grow up with that were Chinese American as well.
Mm-hmm. And how did your personal care work when you were a kid growing up in your house? Was it family members who helped take care of you?
Yeah, so that's basically it. You know, it started with mostly my parents doing all the care, especially as I got older and needed more help, you know, that they were always there. And, you know, that as my sisters got a little older, you know, they were involved as well. Like, you know, it's really sort of was this glue, the fact that every member of my family helped me with my personal care. In a lot of ways, I was kind of a hub where we were all connected.
Did you enjoy high school?
Oh, gosh. Well, do you want the truth?
Yes.
Do you want the truth? Okay, hang on. I am so glad you asked me this question, because now I can just publicly call out my high school I just was so eager to leave that high school. That I was one of those kids who had senioritis, like, way before I was a senior. Like, I knew life was going to be so much better once I got out of college. You know, I got to tell you, you know, I got in touch with my rage at an early age, and it served me well. I will just say that.
You can thank your high school experience for tapping into your rage. I want to understand just so I get what was the feeling at the time. Did you have an experience of, were people directly cruel to you and bullied you, or was it more the feeling of just being invisible and not seen?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very ironic because I was invisible and yet so painfully visible at the same time. Mm. You know, I was one of the few wheelchair users at that school. You know, so my locker was a desk in the nurse's office because all the lockers were inaccessible and they just didn't even, you know, think about, oh, like, maybe we should segregate her this way. Another thing, my bus, it had to drop me off to my high school about 30 or 40 minutes before school started.
Oh.
Because that was a bus that took other disabled students to another school.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get to school, and it would be pitch dark. But I would just, like, sit alone and just wait for the students to arrive. Like, that was my high school experience. I will say that I had a teacher that refused to just advance me to the next level of a drama class that I was taking. So, you know, I had a, which crushed my dream. So, if you have time for this story, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I want to hear it. I love the high school stories.
I did not realize we were going to go in this direction, but I am here for this. You're just giving me a gift. The salty gift. Okay. So, as a sophomore, one of the things that I loved as an elective was drama. So I took drama one taught by this tutor.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the year, I had a B, and I signed up for drama two for the next year. And she called me after class and said, you need to speak to your guidance counselor. I'm like, oh, okay. So I go to my guidance counselor, and she said, the teacher was not going to advance me to drama two because she had concerns whether I could fulfill the requirements. And let me tell you, the passing requirements, there was a section on pantomime. And because I'm a wheelchair user, she just presumed I can't do pantomime from a freaky chair.
Wow.
And I was like, are you sure? She said, yes. So I went back to the teacher and I said, I guess I asked her to, like, you know, reconsider. She just shook her head and said, I'm sorry, I don't think so. You know, I was just, it was one of the few things that I enjoyed. And she said I couldn't continue this because of my disability. And she had no imagination or even willingness to be flexible. And for an adult, you know, especially an educator who supposedly, you know, is supposed to, you know, bring up young people and get the best out of them, she got the best rage out of me.
I'm curious, so you felt rage. As a teenager, did you tell people what had happened, that had been withheld from you?
You know, I told my friends, and, you know, they all felt horrible. But, you know, we didn't, like, protest. We didn't, like, create a ruckus. And, you know, the 46-year-old me would have done some serious stuff. But, you know, at that time, I think I was already so self-conscious. And I, frankly, because of the counselor and the teacher, I didn't think anybody else in the administration honestly would have my back. Mm. I also didn't really share this that much with my parents because, and I regret that, like, now. Mm. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, I think they were very kind of careful how they advocated for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay too, because, you know, in a lot of ways, I place the responsibility on advocating for myself. And that's, you know, how I learned to be self-reliant and just
how to make a ruckus.
Later on, yeah, look at me now. Look at me now.
Coming up, Alice finally gets to go off to college, but the reality of attending was hard.
It was a real, you know, letdown for me. I mean, I had dreams, I had ambitions, I had friends there. But, you know, again, you know, it's about the long game, because, you know, the real dream was to leave Indiana, to be honest.
A couple of weeks ago, I talked with Joanne Allen, who hosts the podcast Been There, Done That. She told me about what her own experience of getting older has been like, especially in the last year. And we told you that Joanne is going to be hosting a special project for Death, Sex, and Money about aging. And judging from how many of you we've already heard from, this is something you are ready to talk about too.
I'm grateful for my wrinkles. I'm grateful for my sagging chin. I am grateful for my gray hair. And I'm even grateful for my aches and pains.
I have noticed a lot of changes in my sexuality just in the last few years.
Unlike Joanne, I don't like getting older, but I'm trying to deal with it.
Life has changed. I'm excited. It's a little nerve-wracking, and I find getting older to be, well, it's inevitable, and I'm trying to do the best damn job I can of it.
Our inbox is full of your stories about all the things that are good about getting older and a lot of the things that are hard too. So if you're over 60, we want to hear from you too. Tell us, what's your life like right now? And how are you feeling your age differently this year than last year? You can record a voice memo or send us an email to deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. You can also leave us a message at the phone number 917-740-6549.
If you missed that episode where I talked with Joanne about her own experience of getting older, check it out. You can find it at deathsexmoney.org/aging. And if you're not over 60, you can still help us spread the word about this project and send that episode to someone in your life who is. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Alice Wong started college in 1992, 2 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act became law. She enrolled at Earlham College, her dream school, a Quaker liberal arts college about an hour and a half away from home, where Alice says only one dorm was accessible to her at the time.
I was the first wheelchair user ever. They had to renovate a bathroom just so I could use that bathroom. So this was the one bathroom in my dorm on campus that I could use.
This was the only bathroom on campus you could use?
Yes.
Wow.
You know, I was determined to attend this private school because, you know, I was driven by the academics. There was a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, it was thrilling to be on my own.
When you went to Earlham, when you first left home and lived in that dorm, was that the first time you had personal care assistants who weren't related to you?
Yes, it was.
So you're an 18-year-old woman, and just what was, Did anyone help you figure out how to communicate with them about how you wanted to be touched, treated, cared for? How did you learn about that?
Yeah, that was a real learning curve. And I think being able to direct my care with my family members, you know, was definitely helpful. I think, you know, when you rely on others for most activities of daily living, speaking for myself, but I think other people in my situation would also, they might agree with me that you learn how to listen very well. Do you learn how to pick up nonverbal cues? You also learn how to really communicate in a way that's effective. So, you know, you really learn how to, like, sense the situation and also adjust to it. So, like, you know, there were different people that came. Sometimes, you know, I would have somebody I'd never met before, and they have to help me use the bathroom. So, you know, I had to be, you know, comfortable with my body, comfortable with somebody, you know, touching my body who I just met for the first time. But, you know, I've always tried to stress that I'm the expert. You know, I'm there to tell you that this is the way I prefer to be lifted, or, you know, X, Y, Z, because, you know, bossy pants, you know, and, you know, it's not a problem for me to say, can you do it this way? But you just had to be super organized in your brain, you know, and also be, like, really clear.
Wait, when you say organized in your brain, do you mean, what does that mean? Like, what are the things that you're having to make sure are sorted?
Yeah, so it's always anticipating what's next, anticipating what could go wrong. You know, somebody, what if somebody drops me, or what if somebody doesn't want to do something the way I asked them to? You know, all the different kind of variables, but also be mindful again, like, how much time do I have left? You know, am I going to get all the stuff that I need help with done in time before they leave? Because they won't be back for another 5 or 6 hours. So, like, there's a constant internal evaluation of, you know, getting my stuff together. You know, after a few months, you know, it did become more difficult to get around campus when it was snowy and icy. And I got sick. And I actually ended up having respiratory failure and almost died not even halfway into my first semester. So once that happened, I actually had to take a year off of school. So I went back home, was completely sad, when all my friends were, you know, living the campus life. You know, I had to be the grown-up and decide, okay, I'm going to stay at home. I'm going to commute to Indianapolis and downtown, to where there was a Indiana University at Indianapolis campus. So this is the local commuter campus that a lot of, you know, non-traditional and just, you know, working people already have, were there for maybe a second degree or a midlife, you know, career change. This was as far different as you get from all of college.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was incredibly, you know, difficult at the beginning. I mean, again, I'm so thankful for my parents because they drove me to class. I mean, you know, I didn't have an accessible car. You know, they were there for me. And it actually ended up having a fantastic experience at Indiana University that completely surprised me.
It strikes me, Alice, it's interesting that it was the campus that served non-traditional students that was the one that could imagine possibilities for you that people in high at your high school or at the private fancy liberal arts school could not.
And I feel like that was such a humbling thing because with all of my kind of assumptions and, you know, judgments, you know, I had wonderful opportunities to learn and grow. You know, it really was a better situation, even though I didn't have all of the bells and whistles that one would want as a young person. For all the, you know, I didn't go to parties. I didn't do anything wild. But that's why I am the party animal that I am now.
Alice finally left Indiana for San Francisco in 1997 to get her master's in medical sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. And being there was a lot of what she'd hoped for.
It immediately felt like home because suddenly you saw like so many Asian Americans.
Uh-huh.
It was such a relief. It was like I was just so much thrilled, and of course, the food, like the culture, the weather, the diversity, just all of the things that are right at your footstep, your doorstep. I think that was so exciting. That was really the lifestyle, you know, I envisioned for myself.
What did you do on the weekends when in that time of your life when you were first getting to know the city?
Yeah, I was just so lucky just exploring all the different neighborhoods, like going to parks, going to like Golden Gate Park. I was actually walking distance from my campus to Golden Gate Park, which is amazing. And, you know, I love to eat public transit, so like public transit was accessible. That was thrilling. You know, being able to go to Berkeley and Oakland all by myself. That would have never happened.
Had you ever done that before? Like to be able to travel around the city by yourself?
Never ever. So that was extremely thrilling. And all the little things was just an adventure.
When you moved to San Francisco, did your parents also move?
Well, funnily enough, at that time, it was incredibly difficult finding and retaining workers, but really, there was no ladder of ways to advance, and there were very few benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, it was, you know, just so competitive for so many jobs that are just far better paid.
Mm-hmm.
That the plan was that I was going to, you know, strike out on my own. But my mom, who was there to help me, through the adjustment period, you know, once I found a set of people, you know, she ended up staying with me. And what was really funny is my mom ended up having her own kind of renaissance because she went back to school when I was in school. She went to service, she first took classes through community college, and then she went to San Francisco State University. So my mom ended up getting a master's of social work.
I love that she moved out to help you, and what could from the outside, you know, just sort of like when you hear that part of the story, you think like, oh, maybe you felt hemmed in by having your mom there, and maybe your mom felt some sense of obligation, but that both of you were able to find a real sense of freedom and expansion in this new life together is so cool.
It was her time, you know, after raising three kids and being, you know, a mom, just it was her time. And I think that was really exciting to see.
Alice's dad eventually moved to San Francisco to join them as well. And these days, while Alice's parents still help with her care, she's also thinking about their care as they get older.
During this pandemic, you know, and even before that, I was planning ahead and going to, you know, hire a new set of workers because I did have some home care workers, you know, throughout the years that would, you know, provide supplemental assistance because, you know, it shouldn't be all of my parents. But with this pandemic and not feeling safe, yeah, it's definitely not the time right now. Mm-hmm. And I have this, you know, I have this luxury of living with my parents who are my care workers. You know, we, ironically, right around the time the pandemic kind of really started to emerge that we all did our advanced directives. I think, you know, it's very just strange timing, but also it's a lot of adulting that, you know, I'm glad I did because you just kind of never know. I just need to plan ahead.
Wait, so when you just did your advanced directive?
I did it around March.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it was just very kind of a funny kind of coincidence or convergence of events. So, you know.
So you're in your mid-40s. What prompted you to do your advanced directive in March?
Well, you know, my parents were, you know, estate planning because they're both in their 70s. And you know, we really want to make sure that, you know, their wishes are, you know, fully in a document and, you know, they get everything in order so that my sisters and I later on, you know, down the line, we'll have to make some really difficult decisions. So, you know, we've had these conversations and I've been meaning to do it for years, but, you know, it's so difficult when you have parents who are a bit stubborn and both of my parents are a bit kind of creeped out by it, but you know, but they kept, you know, they, you know, the us as kids, adult kids, we tried to like encourage them that this is, you know, this is good, you know, we should get through this.
Have you noticed your relationship with them change as you're noticing them aging? That after a lifetime of them looking out for you, are you noticing some of their physical limitations in a way that is changing the way you all relate to each other?
Yeah, I would say that, even though in my early life, you know, I did rely on them for a lot, you know, just even at an early age, we were all very interdependent. As the oldest child, you know, I did help a lot, you know, in different ways. Like, I know I contributed to the family that I was more than just somebody who required care. Mm-hmm. And I think they also saw me that way as well. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, when I was younger, I was really good with, like, reading directions and just, like, on the road, like, I would just, you know, don't forget to exit off this highway. You know, that was me.
Uh-huh. Boss of pants.
Yeah, boss of pants. I would plan, like, to do all the research about, like, where we're going to stay, where we're going to eat, what we're going to do. They would appoint me, but I was a self-appointed organizer in chief. And I'm proud of that. And, you know, I think my parents also kind of, they appreciate me as much as I appreciate them.
That's Alice Wong. Her new book is called Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. You can check out her podcast, also called Disability Visibility, wherever you listen. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm usually based at the studios of the investigative podcast Reveal in Emeryville, California. Afi Yellowduke produced this episode. The rest of our team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thanks to Mia Gerritsen in St. George, Utah, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Mia and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. Alice told me she is proud of her new book and also likes to think what her teenage self would be able to do with it if she were back in high school.
I would have probably shoved that book in front of this tutor's face and say, hey, look at these badass disabled people doing all kinds of things. Don't play me into thinking that I can't do freaky pantomime. You know? I mean, I have the receipts. And then I would have wheeled on out of there.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.